The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Ewan Potts.
Well, coming up on today's programme, we're going to be speaking to Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University, on his new book, The Conservative Party After Brexit.
But first, Suella Braverman has been lashing out against the UK's soaring levels of immigration. To a standing ovation at the NatCon UK conference, the Home Secretary also railed against experts and elites, branded identity politics as illiberal, and said conservatism has no truck with political correctness. In an echo of a slogan from the Tories' 2005 election campaign, she said, "It's not racist for anyone, ethnic minority or otherwise, to want to control our borders."
Not quite as an obvious appeal to the base as the Guardian reading tofu eating wokearati, but hey ho. Braverman says that there's no good reason the UK can't train its own lorry drivers and fruit pickers to help to bring immigration down. But with the labour market tight, although signs of cooling in the latest data, and more on that shortly, industry groups are among those calling for more immigration, especially after Brexit cut the free passage of workers from the European Union.
Yeah, it's such a rumbling debate in the Tory party, this, isn't it? I feel it's going to get even hotter as these immigration stats come out later this month. But there are some in the Tory party who worry about the economy and the shortage of workers. And there are many in the Tory party who would like less immigration, which is at record levels. Interesting on the fruit picking, actually, because it's one of those jobs that you assume that no Brits do anymore. But actually, when I was a kid, my mum's best friend used to pick fruit in the summer, and she was from a very comfortably off family, but it was something that people did. They went and did it. We did live in Kent, admittedly, but she went and picked fruit in the summer. So it hasn't always been done by immigrants, and this isn't years and years ago. It was a little while ago. Lizzie's looking at me like I'm ancient, but I think it's a job which has become something that Brits don't want to do. And of course, in a very tight labour market, people have a lot of options.
Well, this is Braverman's argument, isn't it? Can we turn back time? Anyway, to discuss those jobs data from this morning, in the studio we're joined now by senior economics reporter Philip Aldrich and Dave Goodman, who writes Bloomberg's Markets Today blog. Thanks both for being in the studio with us.
Hi, Lizzie. So I think the key thing for inflation in the numbers, at least for now, is wage growth is still very elevated. It kind of came in as expected, over 6%. That's still pretty chunky, and is going to be a worry for the BOE. Maybe further out, some wage growth is a very lagging indicator, very backward looking. Some of the indicators that were more forward looking suggested we could be in for some easing in the labour market. for example, the inactivity rate has come down a lot, and it looks like that's on a trend to carry on falling, which may ease some of these concerns over tightness you were just talking about there. Also, for April, which is the most up-to-date number we got from HMRC about payrolls data, that showed a really big drop off, 136,000 fewer workers on the payroll. Big caveat, that number is very prone to big revisions, so who knows, this time next month we could be saying that wasn't as bad as we thought. But I think that's why the market said this is potentially quite a dovish report, because there are these signs that there is finally some easing in the labour market, and that might allow the BOE to think about stopping hiking, which some of them seem quite keen to do based on some of the comments we've had recently.
And it's good news for the PM.
Yeah, not some good news for the people losing their jobs. Quite a dramatic number, wasn't it, actually? The biggest downward number in that data series since the pandemic. Phil, I want to talk about another big number, which is the immigration stats due out in a couple of weeks' time. There's expected to be bad news to the government, and it's going to show a big rise in net migration. What do you think of Suella Braverman's call for more Brits to be trained in fruit picking and truck driving and other things that they haven't thus far shown much inclination to do?
Well, full disclosure, like you, I sorted potatoes on a farm when I was younger as well. But the argument has long been that if part of the investment problem in the UK is that we've always relied on cheap foreign labour. So she's just sort of riffing off that economic principle that if we have to pay more for our workforce, then there is going to be a greater incentive to invest to increase our productivity, and we haven't had that investment before. We haven't had that incentive as clearly as it is now before. So that, I guess that's her point. I don't know how much innovation she's expecting in fruit picking. Although there's a lot of sort of farmers who are moving to robotics and even automation in that industry. So the high immigration numbers really are expressing, you know, the Ukraine and Hong Kong immigrants, and there's been a big influx of international student numbers. The concern is that if you have a big increase in asylum seekers, or you know, people like the Ukrainians flooding in, it's going to make the Tories less willing to accept a big increase or to accept a lot of economic migration. And it's the economic migration that is the problem here. We do want workers in. The visa regime is relatively loose. We do want skilled workers into the UK. That is the principle that the government under Boris Johnson set up. But if you've got a very high level of asylum seekers who are not in principle coming here specifically to work, then the Tories are probably going to try and push down on the bit that they can control. So they'll stop as many, you know, more valuable economic migrants coming into the UK. And so then that's going to affect the labour market. And you hear this is a concern among the employers out there, that, you know, we have a labour supply shortage. We do need to fill these gaps in some way, and at the moment there isn't enough British workers to do it.
The other way that jobs are getting political, of course, is Labour's promising a legal right to switch off, so bosses won't be able to contact workers outside work hours. Dave, is that going to have any impact on the likes of our listeners? You know, most of them tend to sign away the right to limited working hours anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to see how that plays out. And in the kind of, as you say, in the kind of modern world, it's quite hard to imagine switching off from things like email and WhatsApp and how much that will...
You're always on Twitter.
Exactly, yeah. And always on WhatsApp. But yeah, so how that kind of cuts through will be interesting. Just going back to Phil's point quite quickly about automation and investment, one of the big things about Brexit, I remember writing this back in 2017, was that people were really hoping that it would spark this kind of big investment in things like machinery and as the kind of cheap foreign labour dried up, and that would be the thing that would solve up. That was one of the many things that was going to solve the UK productivity puzzle. That hasn't come through, and it's really not a case where we've got huge numbers of British workers doing nothing anymore. It's actually there's too many people have jobs, and there isn't this kind of pool of labour to do these jobs either. So maybe this is another thing that could drive some of that investment. But at the moment, it doesn't really seem like that's the way it's heading, particularly in some of these industries, if you still have a kind of source of labour that's cheaper.
Mm.
Couldn't it be argued that the tight labour market is exactly what people were voting for in 2016? So, you know, we've lost all these workers from the EU and the labour market is very tight and there are jobs for, in most places, for people, everybody who wants one.
Well, that's it. I mean, you've got fewer workers, therefore you're going to have to bid up wages. And this is what you know, the government at the time was saying, that they wanted, you know, people to be paid better in the UK. But of course, if you're paid better without the productivity improvements, that's just going to push up prices. And so, you know, then it comes back to what we were talking right at the start about, which was the Bank of England looking at the wage data going, crikey, we can't have 6.7% wage inflation because that's way out beyond the limits of sustainable consumer price inflation. So we've got to get that down. So we've actually got to drive people into unemployment potentially to bring that wage number down. So, you know, on the one hand, yes, we do want to have a higher wage economy. That is very clear. But on the other hand, if it's not sustainable because we're not generating the investment and we're not delivering that productivity, all it's going to do is just push prices up. And so, you know, the recipe here that, you know, Suella Braverman, I suppose, is unthinkingly, you know, prescribing is basically a higher wage but higher inflation economy. And that's the higher inflation bit is missing from the analysis.
The other thing that markets seem to have been reacting to this morning was Bank of England chief economist Hugh Pill's relatively dovish comments yesterday, and he also apologised for saying that Brits should accept they're worse off. I kind of want to put this to both of you. What's the upshot of this? Is it only politicians who should be talking about who's going to hurt in a cost of living crisis? Start with you, Dave.
Yeah, I think, as ever with the BOE, I think Hugh Pill was making an economic point and thinking of that solely in terms of economics and not really thinking about how it would go down with the wider population. So the way he was talking was, I mean, obviously, if inflation has been so elevated, you don't have this kind of constant pass-the-pass, as he said, where prices go up, wages go off. That kind of carries on. And people, at some point, someone has to say, well, we can't carry on passing these through, or we can't have higher wages. He just expressed it in a way that was a kind of like, obviously quite going to really cause a backlash against him by saying we have to accept that we're poorer, when it's kind of the BOE's job to keep inflation lower, and they've obviously haven't done a particularly good job of that recently.
But
yeah, I mean, it was a poorly phrased comment. I think it's a sort of expression of the frustration that he and the Bank of England has with what's going on in the, you know, with inflation, which is it has got embedded into our domestic our economy, rather than it's not just an energy price problem, it's not just a supply chain problem, it's embedded in our economy, and we've now got into what, you know, economists talk about as sort of conflict, inflation conflict, where, you know, one side of the equation, you know, as Dave was saying, the employers are trying to claw back their squeezed margin with higher prices, and on the other side, because prices are higher, the workers are saying, crikey, I need to be paid more, so my wages have to go up, and it passes from one to the other. And as long as that conflict persists, you know, you're going to have this dynamic, and I think the Bank of England is seeing that conflict, seeing that that persistence, and wishes one person or one side of the, you know, the equation could just take the hit. You know, if shareholders would say, we're not going to take dividends for 18 months, you know, we're going to sort this out, we're going to take a massive hit onto the employer side, onto the corporate side, and so we will not put prices up, then you potentially could you would end up slightly resolving this issue, because then the wages would not go up, because there would be no need to recover recover wages, and then everything would sort of stabilize at a higher price level. But as long as that conflict exists, you know, no one's going to stop, because they keep on, and so it keeps on pushing it up. And that's the past inflation that that Hugh Pill was talking about. And it's he expressed it poorly. It's a sensible sort of explanation, but I think there's, you know, real frustration with the banks. They, you know, theoretically, that means they've got to push people out of work to stop this, to stop the inflation to keep on rising.
If only they could find a less clumsy way of expressing it, that would be ideal. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio, both of you. That's Phil and Dave. Philip Aldrich and Dave Goodman from our economics team.
Now, this morning's UK jobs data also revealed that the number of working days lost to strikes rose to over 500,000 in March. Speaking of passing the parcel, passing the pay, this morning's UK jobs data also revealed that the number of working days lost to strikes rose to over 500,000 in March. To explain the political impact, he's back. It's our strikes reporter, Asad Zulfikar. Asad, thanks so much for coming back into the studio. What damage have the strikes done to the UK economy?
Well, on the working days front, you know, it brings the ONS's total tally to over 3.5 million days lost. But in pound sterling, the Centre for Economics and Business Research has estimated a total direct cost to the UK of £1.2 billion in the 12 months to June, or only 0.05% of annual GDP. Now, that's not a lot in and of itself. However, indirect costs are, of course, harder to calculate. There's often an environmental cost, for instance, when travel plans are disrupted and people drive cars instead of boarding trains en masse. Then there's the public health cost of missed cancelled appointments or treatments amid NHS strikes concerning junior doctors, nurses, paramedics and other staff. Then there's the costs of, you know, when people are working from home because their teachers, well, their kids' teachers are on strike and they can't quite be as productive as they want to be. And so there's a sort of knock-on effect there with their own workplace. And so there are all these other indirect costs which will be felt throughout the country in much more subtle ways that are harder to quantify, but that, you know, aren't doing amazing things for a country sort of attempting to restart its growth project.
Now, I said I can't get my head around it, but just talk us through who has settled and who is still on strike. It's a complicated picture.
It is a complicated picture. It's a constantly shifting picture. I mean, it's so some there have been some big settlements. So like the Royal Mail, of course, have settled. There have been rail settlements in Scotland and Wales. There have been buses settlements and so on. But there's still a whole bevy of disputes going on. For instance, in the NHS, non-medical staff had agreed a deal. However, nurses who are contained within this Agenda for Change scheme, which includes, you know, like paramedics and cleaners and so on, They get the deal because it got voted on overall, but they don't actually think it's enough for them. So they're continuing on with their dispute. I mean, Pat Cullen, the General Secretary of the RCN, is speaking today in a Congress in Brighton for the union. And she's going to tell members to continue to vote for strike action because they think they can negotiate a better deal still. And the NHS has, you know, problems beyond the nurses as well. I mean, junior doctors are still sort of in dispute. There are talks about talks, I think, at the moment. However, you know, senior doctors are now beginning to vote for strike action as well. So the NHS is far from out of the woods. And rail strikes, of course, are still going on as everyone trying to go to Liverpool this weekend for Eurovision probably found. And people might find in a month's time when they try and go to the FA Cup final in Wembley from Manchester. Mm. However, it's sort of, I feel like people are beginning to feel like there's progress because there's a bit more negotiation going on. And so, with inflation forecast to fall, it seems like perhaps some of what's been biting is going to bite less.
Our strikes reporter, Asad Zulfikar, really great to have you back on.
Now, a recent history of a UK political party would not normally include four prime ministers and two general elections. This has not been a normal few years in British politics. Tim Bale's new book, The Conservative Party After Brexit, Turmoil and Transformation, covers the dramatic ups and downs since the referendum back in June 2016.
Well, I'm glad to say that Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, joins us now. Tim, thanks so much for being on the programme. I wonder, were you inspired to chronicle the Conservatives' recent history because you think their time in office may be over soon?
Well, that's a question I kind of leave open at the end of the book, just as a spoiler. The Conservative Party has got an incredible record of sometimes coming back from defeat or near defeat. So I wouldn't totally write them off. But I do wonder whether, in fact, now, you know, finally their time has come.
Huh. OK. What were the challenges then of writing a book? I mean, it's such recent history. A lot of the key players are so involved still in current politics. How do you get a bit of perspective?
Well, that is always a bit of an issue when you're writing about recent events. You're right. But I think being an academic helps in the sense that I do have, because I got a research grant actually to write this book, a little bit more time to take a slightly longer view. And I'd also say that having some familiarity with the Conservative Party's history really throughout the post-war period means that hopefully I'm able to kind of set things in a little bit of context. So while I think it is important to chronicle the flow of events, because I think, you know, politicians do live in a kind of 24/7 media environment and there's a lot coming at them all the time. So I don't think you can go too far in taking the long view, if you like, all the time. I do think it's possible to get just a little bit more perspective on things than perhaps would be the case if I was involved in, you know, like you guys having to report it day in, day out.
Tim, take us back to the start of this period, the run-up to that fateful election for Theresa May. Really interesting to read in the book about some of the polling evidence presented to the Tories ahead of that election. And unlike the media narrative, it didn't say that the Tories would be certain to get a landslide, did it?
No, it didn't. One of the interesting things about a couple of the interviews I did with Tory strategists was to reveal quite how uncertain certainly some of them were about the necessity for an election and indeed the, you know, the sagacity of calling one in the first place. I think they were quite persuaded by the research which suggested that the public couldn't really see a reason for an election in the first place, given that Theresa May had a majority and regarded it really as a bit of a kind of waste of time and effort, and just wanted the government to get on with actually both delivering Brexit and tackling some of the other problems that the UK was facing. It's also the case, it has to be said, that they did in the end agree to that election, but I think partly because they weren't as familiar with Theresa May's, let's call them downsides, as perhaps they should have been, and people who were closer to Theresa May, to Theresa May were. So they hadn't really realised quite how poor a campaigner she would be. So I think created a strategy where she was going to carry the party without knowing that actually she just wasn't capable of doing that.
Is Johnson a one-off? I mean, the Conservative Party seems to be swinging between kind of charismatic leader and technocrats. I mean, you talk about Rishi Sunak. You could also make comparisons to Theresa May in the sense that he's quite untested at a national level, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. Very often, I think, when political parties are choosing the next leader, they've often been known to react, as it were, against the current leader. So I think there is something in that. I mean, Boris Johnson, I think, though, is an exceptional character in the sense that really, I think, in contrast to many Conservatives, he really is, you know, devoid of much ideology or indeed many ideas, and doesn't really have much of a sense of what he wants to do when he gets into government, other than to get into government itself and to be prime minister or world king, as sometimes people put it. He's obviously got this connection with some voters, although I would say the polling evidence suggests that it's not quite the kind of Heineken effect that some Conservative politicians who are big fans of Boris Johnson sometimes refer to. I mean, certainly in the 2019 election, for example, which many people think of as Boris Johnson winning for the Conservative Party, it's very notable that actually he's less popular with voters than Theresa May was throughout the course of the 2017 campaign. So I guess it's his ability to appeal to a target group of voters in that 2019 election, and particularly obviously voters from the Red Wall, if you like, that helped the Conservatives. But it was by no means Boris Johnson himself that won that election. It was Boris Johnson's promise to get Brexit done. And then, very importantly, actually to get on with all the things that people really wanted to see, which was investment in public services, for example, that Brexit was holding up.
Tim, I want to ask you about that. Is Brexit done? I don't mean all those negotiations with Brussels, but I mean its influence on British politics. We saw a Brexit unwind starting to appear in the local elections, whereby people who voted one way or the other are going back to their traditional parties. Do you think that the referendum still hangs over British politics, or are we moving past that now?
No, I think that is a really good question, particularly, as you say, in light of the local elections, which do suggest that actually Brexit seems to be playing less of a part, perhaps, in voters' considerations when they're choosing which party to vote for. I mean, I think it is fair to say that Brexit did have a very big influence after 2016, in the sense that it seemed to sort voters into the two main parties. So you had a lot of Leave voters who previously might have automatically almost voted for Labour coming over to the Conservatives, and actually, weirdly enough, beginning to favour Conservative policies across a whole range of things other than Brexit. And then, of course, you had a whole bunch of Remain voters, but just not as many of them moving over to Labour and to some extent the Liberal Democrats. But I do think that actually we are beginning to see Brexit disappear in the rearview mirror as far as most voters are concerned. But I think the important thing to realise is that Brexit you know, wasn't important simply in and of itself. It was important in some ways, the kind of cutting edge of a deeper, you know, cultural divide, if you like, in the British electorate, between people who, you know, regarded, you know, some of the changes that have gone on in British society for, you know, decades really as uncomfortable, as unwelcome, and wanted to do something about it. And I think, you know, that cultural divide is still there, and it plays out demographically between older, whiter, less educated voters on the one hand, and younger, better educated, and often, you know, slightly more multi-ethnic voters on the other.
Well, I want to ask a question about that, looking forward to the next election. I mean, we're going into the kind of second media age, as it were, AI, in terms of the internet. The role of the right-wing press in all of this, especially around the implementation of Brexit and Partygate and everything else, is it still the kind of most important bellwether, you know, the backing of the red top newspapers or the right wing newspapers for one candidate or another, sealing it? Do you think that's still necessary?
Well, there is an irony here, and in some ways I detect it in your question, which is that, you know, sales of these newspapers have declined precipitately over the years, and yet they still seem to have this influence within the Conservative Party in particular. Despite the fact that actually decades of research has shown us that they don't have as much impact on voters as many politicians seem to think they have. I think the way to understand the Tory press, and I go into this in the book actually, is to see it as an integral part of the Conservative Party. So in other words, it's not something that exists outside of the party. It's actually what I call the party in the media. So it's helped set the agenda for the Conservative Party, and it's often the forum in which you know, people with ambitions conduct, as it were, their conflicts with each other. And I certainly think if we're talking about Conservative Party members, it's probably true that the Conservative supporting newspapers do have more of an effect than they do on voters more generally when they come to choose a leader, which is why you see throughout the book, and we will see it in the future as well, anybody who is going for the leadership continually trying to appeal to those particular newspapers. And this is very evident actually in the sort of last year of the Johnson regime as much as anywhere else, when you have Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak quite clearly briefing the newspapers all the time, very often after cabinet meetings, which are supposed to be secret after all, and suggesting, for example, you know, that they want to you know, free up things much faster than Johnson does when it comes to COVID. So I think it's impossible really to understand the modern Conservative Party without understanding the influence of, you know, papers like The Telegraph, The Mail and The Express, and even perhaps, dare I say it now, GB News.
Yeah, former Chancellor described Liz Truss to me as a leaker in chief. I'll leave them unnamed. Look, Tim, will you settle something for us? I want to know, is Rishi Sunak really a Brexiter? The conspiracy theory goes that he only picked the Leave side because he had to in order to win his seat. And I speak to lots of people in the city who just can't fathom how someone with a finance background like his could have been pro-Leave.
That's a really good question. And I think the answer is yes. I mean, I think it is true that a lot of Conservative MPs, in order to get selected, had to burnish their Eurosceptic credentials. But I don't think they necessarily needed to say that they were leavers, not at the point anyway that Rishi Sunak won his seat. I do think he is a true believer. Quite why that is the case is difficult, as you say, to fathom, because most people involved in international business would regard, you know, the erection of, you know, barriers to trade between the EU and the UK as a bad idea. Perhaps, though, it is something to do with, you know, his belief that actually Britain's future is global rather than European, if you like. And that might come down to the fact that, you know, he is of Indian origin, and also he studied in the United States. So it gives him a slightly different perspective, perhaps.
Tim, how different is the Conservative Party of 2023 to the Conservative Party on the eve of that referendum, which David Cameron was set to win back in the summer of 2016?
I mean, it's easy to see it as chalk and cheese, isn't it, really? Because I think what we have then is a party run by, you know, a self-confessed liberal conservative who, OK, was very Thatcherite on the economy, austerity and all that, but actually had the measure of a country that was becoming increasingly socially liberal, was becoming increasingly multi-ethnic, and I think wanted to project the Conservative Party quite clearly into the middle of the 21st century in that respect. And then, you know, now we have a Conservative Party that is, as I say in the book, a kind of ersatz populist radical right party, in the sense that, you know, it pits the elites against the people. It's very strongly anti asylum seeker, anyway, if not immigration, on the quiet. It wants to attack the establishment as much as it possibly can. It plays to people's fears about social change, and targets in some ways a rather different audience. Having said that, however, I think you can see in the Conservative Party, really all the way, you know, from the late 20th century onwards, a kind of populist strain within the party that has sometimes been appealed to, you know, quite explicitly by Conservative leaders. If you think back to William Hague between 1997 and 2001 and the whole Save the Pound campaign and the whole, you know, let me take you to a foreign land speech that he gave. I mean, that's kind of textbook populism as well. I think the difference now is that, having flirted with populism for a very long time, you know, possibly over decades, even a century or so, the Conservative Party does now seem to have swallowed it whole. And I guess the question is whether, you know, once that's happened, to mix a metaphor, you can put the genie back in the bottle.
Well, that was Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University, speaking to Lizzie Mee and Caroline Hepker.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock, and our audio engineer was John Wasserman. I'm Ewan Potts.
I'm Lizzie Burden, and we'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.